it's Brian Mabry, and this is episode 7 of the Planning and Zoning News Podcast. I'm an urban planner in Elkhart, Indiana, and in this podcast, I read to you news articles related to urban planning and zoning. And that was my childhood friend, Chris McFarlane, bringing us in with the song On the Wing from his record, The Unraveling. Today in this episode, I will cover a sociologist defending cul-de-sacs, strong towns for conservatives, ways to fail at form-based codes, a continuation of that series of articles, and talking about a new plan for Chicago, and then we'll wrap up with a song by the Chicago band Pegboy. But first, we have the article, Toronto's Advertising Sign Companies Push Hard for Digital Billboards, and this was on thestar.com. It was posted Saturday, October 26, 2013, and the author is Betsy Powell. The battle for eyeballs and outdoor advertising space in Toronto is heating up once again, just 4 years after the city enacted a new sign bylaw. At the center of it all are digital billboards. Opponents call them visual pollution. They say they pose a dangerous distraction to motorists and emit vast amounts of light that could potentially disrupt the sleep of thousands of downtown condo dwellers. On the other side is the outdoor sign industry. It says there is no statistically significant link between electronic signs and car crashes, and that the brightness of the signs can be adjusted within the specific limits. Digital signs contribute to the vibrancy of the city, they say. So one might assume the industry would be encouraged and critics discouraged that a city-hired consultant has recommended the expansion of areas where electronic signs be allowed to include commercial and employment zones, but not in residential areas. In fact, neither side is satisfied. What nobody disputes is that digital billboards are an extremely lucrative business, especially in Canada's most populous city. They've come a long way since an East End car dealer's billboard featured a 3-meter-tall female cutout swaying back and forth on an electric-powered swing. It was once one of Toronto's best-known landmarks. Today, electronic signs attract much higher fees than traditional print billboards because the content displayed is fully changeable, allowing multiple advertisers to share space and target their messages to the time of day. McDonald's can market McMuffins in the morning and Big Macs in the afternoon. Adjustments can be made by a software operator off-site. 4 years ago, Out of Home Marketing Association of Canada estimated the gross annual revenues to the industry in the Toronto market will be approximately $72 million annually based on an estimate of $17,300 per sign face multiplied by 4,153 signs. However, the city did its own calculation and estimated the industry earns between $141 and $220 million a year in annual revenue. Electronic signs have invigorated the outdoor sign industry with their maximum reach and massive brand exposure, according to the OMAC website. Members of the association include Astral Media, Pattison Outdoor, CBS Outdoor, and Zoom Media. Large digital screens generate wow factor impressions when they hover over key arterial routes and busy urban streets in all major markets, OMAC boasts. To access this prime real estate, outdoor advertising companies employ a small army of lobbyists who are frequent visitors to city councilors. The sign industry's digital push coincides with a growing number of people willing to pay not to be advertised to, people who subscribe to Netflix, listen to satellite radio, or use spam blockers, for example. The industry is saying people can't ignore us when they're outside. They have to leave their house. They have to leave their cars and go to work. They can't choose not to look at our signs, says Max Ashburn, communication director with Scenic America. The Washington, D.C. nonprofit organization is dedicated to preserving and enhancing the visual character of America's communities. In an online article posted in June, Marco Bohr, a Maryland-based senior analyst and consultant to the digital printing industry, wrote that electronic billboards are on an unstoppable path of growth due to the profit they provide their owners. One large publicly traded billboard advertising conglomerate obtains 10 times more profit from electronic billboards than traditional printed billboards, he noted. With the stakes that high, it's not surprising signs are back on the agenda 4 years after Toronto City Council restricted digital billboards to Yonge Dundas Square and the Gardiner Expressway. The industry pushed relentlessly, says Allison Gorbold, a longtime public space activist. The signed bylaws passed in 2010 allowed the industry to submit site-specific applications that permitted electronic signs in other parts of Toronto if certain criteria were met. They made application after application, all of which had to go through council. Council got pretty grumpy about this. Why were they having to look at signs on a case-by-case basis? They had a lot of other issues to talk about. Last year, council asked staff to revisit the issue. They, in turn, tapped Martin Rendell, the same consultant who studied signs for the city in 2009 when there were still relatively few digital billboards. Rendell's recommendation that digital signs be permitted in commercial and employment areas may sound like expansion, but the industry argues it will actually pull the plug on any increase. The reality is that the restrictions of distancing from other signs, coupled with the terms of the existing bylaw, would not allow for new digital signs, OMAC President Roseanne Karen wrote in email. Ted Van Villet, manager of the city's sign bylaw unit, agrees Toronto is not about to turn into a digital billboard jungle if the consultant's recommendations are adopted by staff and ultimately city council. He cited rules already in place that would limit the sites where these signs could be placed. For instance, an electronic sign can't face an open space such as a park or be placed anywhere there's a residential building within a 250-meter radius. There will be some locations where new digital signs may be permitted. However, in many cases, it could require the removal of an existing sign or signs in order to accommodate new ones, Van Villet says. This is an incredible dodge, responds Gorbold, adding, this is a thin edge of the wedge situation. What they mean is that given the number and placement of existing billboards, it would be difficult to find new locations for billboards, Gorbold wrote in an email. However, the industry doesn't want to keep using all their old, less lucrative billboards and add digital signs. Ideally, they'd like to go all digital. Gorbold cites an example on this week's council agenda. CBS Outdoor wants to erect a giant electronic sign at 486 Evans Avenue next to the Gardiner Expressway in exchange for removing four older billboards. Staff had recommended denying the request because the proposed sign's height, lack of compatibility with the area, and the city's policy against signs within 400 meters of a highway. Gorbold agrees that with Toronto's proposed strategy, the city could actually end up with fewer signs. It already has 4,000 third-party signs owned by advertising companies, or one for every 623 residents. Only 47 of the city's 4,000 third-party signs are electronic billboards. By square footage of billboard clutter, this seems like a win, but in terms of intrusiveness, light pollution, oppressiveness, being impossible to ignore, plus the safety issue, I think this would be a huge loss. Gorbold and the Toronto Public Space Initiative are calling for a moratorium on new electronic billboard applications. Some U.S. cities, such as San Francisco, Denver, Houston, and St. Louis, have banned them outright. Our second article is from theatlanticcities.com, and the title is The Case for Cul-de-Sacs, and it was written by Emily Badger and posted October 17, 2013. In a weird way, Thomas R. Hochschild Jr. actually first encountered the social cohesion of cul-de-sacs in his latest research when he wandered into one in Connecticut with his clipboard and polo shirt and someone called the cops. That never happened on the other types of streets he was studying, places where it would turn out the neighbors didn't know each other as well, and it was clear who belonged. Repeatedly, though, he found at the end of the cul-de-sac, families who watched each other's children and took in each other's mail, who barbecued and orchestrated the removal of snow together, and who considered each other close friends. In cul-de-sacs, these families had a stronger sense of shared social space and territoriality, and outsiders stood out. In sociologists' terms, Hochschild ultimately concluded that people who live in traditional bulb cul-de-sacs have the highest level of attitudinal and behavioral cohesion, covering both how they feel about their neighbors and how much they actually interact with them. People who live on your average residential through street have the lowest levels. In between the two are dead-end cul-de-sacs that lack the traditional circular social space. These findings, which Hochschild has published in the Journal of Urban Planning and Development, may surprise you. Academics who've come to the decidedly controversial cul-de-sac from other angles, traffic management, engineering, and urban planning, have mostly had unflattering things to say about them, many of which we've chronicled. Cul-de-sacs carve up communities in a way that makes them unwalkable. They force people to drive more often and longer distances. As a result, they harm the environment. They're actually less safe than traditional grid streets because drivers speeding through arterials in suburbia don't have to pay as much attention, and cul-de-sacs are harder to reach by fire, police, and emergency crews. Hochschild, now an assistant professor of sociology at Valdosta State University, has heard all of these critiques. "I understand the reasons why," he says. "Some of them are logistical reasons, but I think what they're not taking into consideration are the social advantages of living on a cul-de-sac street." In his latest research, Hochschild visited 110 homes in demographically comparable Connecticut communities, a third of them located on bulb cul-de-sacs, a third on dead-end cul-de-sacs, and a third on through streets. In each case, he tried to interview sets of four adjacent households, as in the diagram above, to home in on how people relate to their immediate neighbors. He asked each household about 150 questions about how they rate their relationship with their neighbors, how often they help each other and socialize together. His results controlled for differences in income, the number of children in a household, and the length of time a family lived on the block. "Time and time again," Hochschild said, "the pattern I saw with these various questions I asked was that people who lived around the circle of the bulb, they thought of their neighbors like family oftentimes." He asked people to respond to this statement. "The friendships and associations I have with my immediate neighbors mean a lot to me." 31.4% of bulb residents strongly agreed. 28.9% of dead-end residents did as well. Only 5.4% of through-street residents felt the same. Similarly, 25.7% of bulb respondents strongly agreed that a feeling of friendship runs deep between me and my immediate neighbors. No one on a through street said that. Families on cul-de-sacs, 40% of them had borrowed or lent food or tools to their neighbors at least once in the previous month. And on the through streets, 18.9% had. Hochschild theorizes that there's something more than self-selection going on here. Hardly any of the people he talked to said they moved to cul-de-sacs in search of or even anticipating its neighborliness. Rather, the design of the street itself seemed to facilitate it. If you want to throw a block party on a through street, you need a permit. If you want to do the same on a cul-de-sac, the street is already effectively blocked off. In a cul-de-sac, Hochschild found, it's much easier to privatize public space, either by turning the street into an extension of the driveway or by landscaping the rights of way as if they were a private lawn. Cul-de-sacs create a kind of natural panopticon around children at play. They also give rise to what Hochschild calls geographically common problems to be solved, like fallen trees or unplowed snow blocking every family's exit. To Hochschild's thinking, all of this means that we may want to weigh the social benefits of the cul-de-sac against the engineering critiques of how they fit into the larger street grid. Or better yet, he envisions designing cul-de-sacs that more directly connect to main walkable routes. Or better yet, he envisions designing cul-de-sacs that more directly connect to main walkable routes to school or the grocery store in an effort to address both schools of thought. As a sociologist, he says, I'm concerned about the breakdown of community and of society, and there's a lot of research that indicates that people today are less likely to know their neighbors. They're less likely to participate in neighborly interaction. Build cul-de-sacs where neighbors might develop that social cohesion, he says, and more people may watch out for each other and feel less alone or alienated. Hochschild's forthcoming research further suggests that people who know their immediate neighbors are also more likely to care about and become involved with their neighborhood at a larger scale. I wouldn't claim that cul-de-sacs are a panacea or cure-all for community problems we're facing, he says. However, I think that it's a piece of the puzzle. Our third article is Strong Towns for Conservatives. This is one of three articles in a series, and I read another one in a series Strong Towns for Libertarians in on the last episode. The third in the series is Strong Towns for Progressives, but this one is Strong Towns for Conservatives, and it was posted Monday, August 12, 2013, and is written by Andrew Burleson. And it is on the Strong Towns website, which is networkedblogs.com/OHKIH. When we travel to cities and towns to share the Strong Towns message, we generally present it in three parts. The current way we are building our cities and towns is financially disastrous, that's one. Two, the objective of our cities should be productivity rather than growth. Three, to get healthy, our cities are going to have to stop business as usual and rethink just about everything. We encounter a wide range of reactions to the Strong Towns message. In my previous post, I talked about the three languages of American politics, an idea I picked up from Arnold Kling on the Econ Talk podcast. In short, Kling suggests that Americans tend to think of the good and the bad in terms of one of three axes. Progressives, oppression versus the oppressed. Conservatives, barbarism versus civilization. Libertarians, coercion versus freedom. It's fair to say that the reactions to our message group into these three categories as well. Today I'm going to start the first of several posts about how we respond to the initial reactions of people of different mindsets, proceeding in order from the most vociferous objections to the least. I'll start with conservatives. More than any other group, conservatives tend to initially react very negatively to the Strong Towns message. In fact, much of the DNA in our organization is built on the idea that conservatives are not seeing the problems with the current development pattern, and that we have to reach out to them and help them see what's going on. So what is it about the Strong Towns message and that conservatives would object to, and how do we respond to that? While Kling describes the conservative axis as civilization versus barbarism, I think this could be also described as stability and continuity versus instability and change. Conservatives tend to believe that things are the way they are for a reason, and that's mostly a good thing. Sure, there are plenty of issues where conservatives call for change, but those are often argued in terms of return to an earlier, better condition. So when we start explaining that growth in the form of horizontal expansion is generally a bad thing, and that we should be focused on productivity instead, conservatives instinctively react against this. After all, we all know, in quotes, that growth is the key to prosperity. If you're not growing, you're dying. Where I find the biggest breakthrough with conservatives is when we explain how the way things are today are not the way things have always been. A number of significant changes took place from the 1930s to today that led us to the status quo. Among the most important concepts, 1. Historically, mortgages were short-term instruments, 5 to 10 years, for no more than 50% of the value of the property. The first fixed-rate amortizing mortgages, 20-year term, 20% down payment, were created by government programs during the FDR administration and sweetened into their current form, 5% down payment, as part of an economic stimulus policy immediately following World War II. 2. Historically, land uses were determined by the property owner with very little intervention from the government. Zoning was conceived of as a tool for relocating industrial pollution out of densely populated areas, but was rapidly adopted across the country as a tool for segregation. Even in places where racial segregation was not official policy, zoning was often intentionally wielded as a tool for keeping different socioeconomic groups separate, and continues to have negative socioeconomic consequences. 3. Historically, cities were built with highly connected street patterns, either as designed grids, most American cities, or organic street networks, see Boston. Starting in the FDR administration, grids were actively discouraged by the government in favor of super blocks and the traffic hierarchy. Historically, streets were seen as shared spaces where many activities took place, driving being simply one of those activities. Led by Ralph Nader and Ashto, this view was dramatically changed in the 60s and 70s. The engineering community adopted a mindset that all streets should be designed according to highway geometries, the idea being that the road should facilitate high-speed driving while also forgiving driver error. This made the historic Main Street, with slow speeds and everything happening close to the street, a non-starter. These changes dramatically reshaped our lives. The fact that they happened over a long enough time horizon that they now seem normal doesn't mean they are historically tried and true. The more you dig into the history of American cities and city planning, the more you find today's norms to be the result of social engineering on a massive scale. That's not the kind of stability and continuity that conservatives are interested in. When we break things down this way, we can usually get people interested in looking back at the history and understanding the context for themselves. For conservatives, that tends to make all the difference in the world. From there, it's easy for us to have a productive conversation about how to build strong towns. Our fourth article is Ways to Fail at Form-Based Codes, Part 2, Make It Mandatory Citywide. This is on the Place Shakers blog, which is placemakers.com. It was posted April 22, 2013 by Hazel Borries. A while back, we talked about connections, community, and the science of loneliness, and how our laws have separated not just building uses, residential, commercial, retail, civic, but have also separated people. And that separation has led a spate of ills, ill health, ill economies, and ill environments. We looked at some of the places that were reversing those use-separated laws of the last 80 years, allowing a mixture of compatible uses where people have a better chance of growing up healthy and aging in place. At the end of that piece, I listed 10 things that can go wrong with a form-based code. Later, we dove into the first of those things, failing to articulate a collective community vision before you can go about the task of changing your out-of-date laws into a more contemporary form-based code that allows people to walk to most of their daily needs. Today, I'd like us to talk about point 2 on the ways to fail list, which is adopt an all-new replacement code without having adequate local support. Form-based codes, or FBCs, can be mandatory citywide or mandatory just for a certain area where locals want to either encourage something different from what's happening right now or preserve and protect existing conditions. Other places would rather spend less time, money, and political will and make the FBC optional but incentivized. Incentives may include a shorter approval process, waived fees, more density, or public-private partnership support structures. Where the failures come in is when a city tries to make the code mandatory for very large areas without going through a transparent and inclusive public process that both establishes a collective local vision and agrees on how it will be implemented. Places that have committed to such a holistic approach are rare and include Miami, Florida, Leander, Texas, Pass Christian, Mississippi, Penn, PA, I don't know what she means by that, if there is actually a Penn, Pennsylvania, Ridgeland, South Carolina, and a number of new FBCs in Ecuador, including Guayaquil, Puerto Ayora, Puerto Velascora Ibarra, Puerto Villamil, Santa Rosa, and Tomas de Berlanga. But that's only 11 out of the 455 form-based codes and process listed in the code study that have undergone mandatory rezoning for the whole jurisdiction. This is a collective effort, so please let us know if we're missing yours. The reasons most places go with a more incremental approach are myriad and include time, money, and political constraints, as well as wanting to encourage growth in areas already served with infrastructure. If you want to really delve into the dynamics, check out this hour-and-a-half discussion led by Jennifer Hurley on implementation strategies. It's important to note that optional form-based codes are only optional at the onset. Once a property owner opts in, the FBC is mandatory for them, so it requires some commitment. It also requires some land, usually a minimum acreage of 80 acres or smaller in an area with generally walkable existing urbanism. Yet another award last week for Ransom, West Virginia, brings to mind this incremental FBC adoption strategy example. Ransom won multiple grants from HUD, Department of Transportation, and EPA to fund a regional form-based code, Green Street Strategy, and Brownfield Remediation. Last week, Ransom was recognized with the EPA Phoenix Award for a fresh take on significant environmental issues, showing innovation and demonstrating masterful community impact. Ransom chose to make their smart code mandatory in Old Town, where there were many non-conforming lots under the existing Euclidean code, which neither reflected nor supported local character. This also enabled the redevelopment of six brownfield sites within frugal, adaptive reuse designs using existing buildings and infrastructure when possible. However, in addition to the Old Town mandatory rezoning, their smart code was enabled as an option for the full jurisdiction. Within the G1, G2, and G3 sectors, developers of 10 to 50 acres may apply for a hamlet or 40 to 200 acres for a village. Within the G3 sector, developers of 80 to 200 acres may apply for a town center. Part of the incentive for developers to use the code was the city being an active planning partner, leading to the rezoning of 1,000 acres of greenfield to the smart code. These new walkable neighborhoods respond to the market demand from the D.C. metro area and connect to the passenger rail that serves D.C. Below are the Jefferson Orchard zoning map and illustrative master plan, with the gray special district showing some industrial uses around the soon-to-be-relocated Duffield's train station. On the far north of the city, Jefferson Orchards has a sector designation of G3 intended growth, allowing for a village, town center, or transit-oriented development community type to optimize the train station relocation in conformance to the new community plan criteria of the smart code. This regulating plan demonstrates a transit-oriented development in addition to a single-use industrial district. It should be noted that lot lines and other details are not typically part of a regulating plan, as this plan is demonstrative. Had the city undergone a mandatory rezoning to a form-based code for the full jurisdiction, they would have also needed to come up with the funds required to retrofit their intended A-grid into walkable streets in order to make the new building's zero-foot setback safe. Choosing instead to concentrate their FBC on the parts of the city with the highest development pressure allows them to bundle their infrastructure investment, create some interesting seed neighborhoods, and step into their placemaking role in a way that makes a difference. And isn't that what a form-based code's really all about? And a fifth and final article is from the Chicago Tribune, and it is titled, "We Seek Your Help in Forging a New Plan of Chicago." And it is by the editor of the Chicago Tribune, Gerald Kern, and it was posted October 6, 2013. To our readers, in 1909, the great architect and planner Daniel Burnham laid out a vision that would shape Chicago's future, a seminal document of sweeping ambition befitting a boisterous, emerging metropolis at the end of a new century. A seminal document of sweeping ambition befitting a boisterous, emerging metropolis at the turn of a new century. It was called the Plan of Chicago, and its legacy is the physical framework of our region today, from the magnificent parks that line the lakefront, to the lush forest preserves ringing our urban areas, to the handsome boulevards and parkways that crisscross our downtown. Burnham had even bigger plans for his plan. Just as he offered holistic solutions to urban planning, he also intended to address societal problems, those that existed a century ago and, sadly, those that remain today. But his final document didn't include those proposals. A quest for a better Chicago. The Chicago Tribune resumes that quest, and we are asking for your help. Today, the Tribune begins a new opinion leadership campaign to create a new plan of Chicago modeled in the spirit of Burnham's blueprint for the city's future. Our campaign is firmly rooted in our deep love of Chicago and the fervent belief that our city can and must improve. For decades, this paper staff has worked to document the challenges facing our city and the ills that plague it, and they are well known. We have shown how our troubled schools and a lack of well-paying jobs have combined to create a vulnerable layer in our society, chronically poor, with little help of escape. Too often, the result is the violent crimes that infest many of our communities. While these appear to be separate problems, they are really facets of a larger whole. Even the best-intentioned, most honest politicians have been hard-pressed to find answers. A penchant for kicking problems down the road, missed opportunities, bad decisions, and strong economic headwinds have left the city and state with bills that cannot pay and needs that cannot be met. By the thousands, the very people who would otherwise be the bulwarks of this community have pulled up stakes and left. In short, our city is on the brink, avoiding the fate of other cities. Other American cities have peered over the precipice and tumbled. Detroit is bankrupt, is downtown a hollow core left by the implosion of a great metropolis. That must not happen here. Over the next 8 Sundays, the Tribune's editorial board, led by editorial page editor Bruce Dold, will present a series of editorials defining the challenges that lie before us and the possible solutions available to the city. We also turn to you, the citizens of Chicago, with a simple question and a challenge. What would you do? How you can help? Call it an RFP, a request for proposals, to address our chronic woes, to make our great city greater, and to ensure that it will survive and thrive into this century and beyond. We seek the ideas of civic groups, foundations, community organizations, and individuals. Over the next few months, we'll publish many of these ideas online and in print. We hope to weave them together into a vision that can inspire a city to action. You can read more about how to participate on today's editorial page or at chicagotribune.com/plan. Like Burnham, we seek holistic solutions. Show us how your plan to improve public education will lead to economic growth, how your anti-crime strategy will pay off with better schools. Tell us how you would pay for it. Illustrate how your idea will create long-term solutions rather than quick fixes, but no idea will be turned away. Feel free to dream, and as Burnham himself said, make no little plans. Our city deserves no less. And that concludes this episode of the Planning and Zoning News podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Zoning News, or go to my Tumblr site, which is zoningnews.tumblr.com. And we'll close this episode with a band from Chicago, Peg Boy. They've been around since the early 90s, and this is their song, Superstar. I'll see you next time. Thanks a lot. Bye. Get away from here. Well, that I can get out there.